Frank is leaving. He may never return. We cry and cry, Mike and I. Mam's tears are pure desolation. Of the 7 children born to her, only 4 remain alive. And now Frank, the oldest, is leaving. I don't know which is worse, Frank's leaving or Mam's tears.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Alfie McCourt is 10 years younger than his famous brother Frank, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Angela's Ashes. He's the third of the gifted McCourt siblings to have written a memoir. In A Long Stone's Throw, Alfie McCourt gives his account of the family history, beginning with the grinding poverty of their Irish neighborhood and crossing the Atlantic to the U.S. Alfie McCourt's is a story of loneliness, hard work, hard drinking, and brotherhood. McCourt spent much of his life working in the bar and restaurant business, but he told Publishers Weekly last year he's always been a writer. If there is a divine, he said, then Angela's Ashes was divinely inspired. It is a masterpiece. My book is man-made. This reading of A Long Stone's Throw took place in October 2008 at the McNally Jackson Bookstore in New York City. The Q&A was conducted with McCourt's editor, Rachel Trushan.
So I thought I would read 2 short pieces, one of which takes place in Limerick. It begins in 1949, when I was 9 years old. And here is how it starts. Where was Moses when the lights went out? In the dark, you Egypt. And that's an old standing joke. And where is my father when the light bulb blows? I surely don't know. But I do know that I have to stand on a chair, remove the spent bulb, and put in the new one. This is all to the good so far. And when I touch an exposed wire, it is even better. Circles of electricity wind through me, coursing from head to toes, toes to head, up and down and up again. I should have waited for Frank to come home from work. He knows about electricity. But I had changed a light bulb before, and I just wanted to show that I could do the job. Now I am going away, away, and further away, still going and for good at 9 years of age, when Mam grabs me and pulls me bodily off the chair and back into life. Frank knows electricity, and he is 19, and he is our leader. Having been born in America, he is bound to be different. And he has a bicycle that I often borrow early on Sunday mornings when the streets are quiet and I go for a ride. In the beginning, I don't ride. Instead, I place my right foot on the left pedal and push off with my left foot. I do the same thing over and over again, scooting, as we call it, just to learn balance. After a few days comes the great moment when I put my left foot on the left pedal, push my right leg in under the crossbar, and thus reach the right pedal with my right foot. Half of my lower body, my right side, is squeezed in and under the crossbar. All of my left side, upper and lower, is suspended for balance away and to the left. Hunched, misshapen, half boy and half bicycle, after many attempts, I finally learn to ride. With this success comes confidence, and with confidence comes more frequent borrowings of the bike. Not only do I use the bike on Sunday mornings, but I take it during the week when Frank is at work to scoot along Barrington Street, up by the public park and the public library in Perry Square, around the monument and back again, performing many circuits. One afternoon, having finished my circuits of Barrington Street and Perry Square, I go hunched riding down the hill toward Kathleen O'Connell's shop. I'm 1 minute from home, just steps away from the lane, when up comes Mr. Duggan on his auto cycle. Mr. Duggan owns and runs the glazier shop at the end of our lane, and he rides a motorized bicycle with a heavy frame and heavy-duty wheels. There is room to pass and to spare. I could steer to the right or to the left of Mr. Duggan and his tank of an motorcycle. Instead, in my state of guilt and nervousness, I am hypnotized and I run straight into him. The motorcycle is intact, but my horse, Frank's precious bicycle, suffers a badly buckled front wheel. I wish for death. If I don't die now, Frank will surely kill me later. Home I go, leaving Frank's wrecked bike in the kitchen. I trudge upstairs and kneel down in search of an upstairs miracle. I launch into an Our Father, three Hail Marys, and a Glory Be to the Father. Downstairs I go to look at the bike. There's no change in its condition. Up I go again to repeat the prayers, and downstairs again. Still no change. And so, after many repetitions, I stop, leaving my prayers, and along with them, my head to be disposed of when Frank comes home. When I confess my crime, "Weren't you the fool?" is all he says, and that's the end of it. My prayers have been answered. So Frank has been saving, and now what we have always known would happen is coming to pass. Frank tells us that he is leaving for the U.S. He has been working from an early age, always with a wide range of interests. He has continued to be a keen student and never wavered in his ambition to return to the U.S. We have the American wake, the going away party for Frank. In slow tempo we sing, "Now is the hour when we must say goodbye. Soon you'll be sailing far across the sea. While you're away, oh please remember me. When you return, you'll find me waiting here." This, our anthem of farewell, the closing song of the American wake, will become fixed and sacred in the rubric of our emigration. Next day, Frank, Mike, and I board a train for Cove, County Cork. Even as late as October 1949, taking ship for America means goodbye forever. Frank is leaving. He may never return. We cry and cry, Mike and I. Mam's tears are pure desolation. Of the 7 children born to her, only 4 remain alive. And now Frank, the oldest, is leaving. I don't know which is worse, Frank's leaving or Mam's tears. That's the first selection. And now we come to something even sadder. Well, I came to New York, and because my brothers were already here and established in New York, I got to spend time in Manhattan, but then through a combination of circumstances, I ended up living in the Bronx. So not many Irish immigrants get to live first in Manhattan before moving to the Bronx. It's lucky for me that I escaped the riot by moving just in time back among the Irish. Seamus Collins, Eddie Deary, and I live at apartment 1C, 1917 Walton Avenue. Seamus writes to his father in Ireland. His father, in writing back, addresses his letter to the Aptic, 1917 Walton Avenue. He has assumed, no doubt, that his son is doing well. Isn't he living in a building with a fancy name? The apartment is on the ground floor and to the rear. There's little daylight and only one bedroom. The living room is the second bedroom. The building, I would guess, had seen better times when it was younger and held a predominantly Jewish population. The synagogue next door abuts the bedroom window where I sleep. On Saturday mornings in the summer, long before air conditioning, it is always 90 degrees and a full-bodied blue bottle fly buzzes the bedroom. Periodically, he touches down on my forehead. Repeatedly, I shoo him away. His antennae are dulled by the fumes of last night's beer. In this secure Irish and Italian neighborhood, life is simple and straightforward if you are not too ambitious and your sensibilities are not hanging out all over. Two bars and a Catholic church are within shouting distance of the Aptic. I can't afford the church, but I make an obeisance at Behan's bar whenever funds will allow. Exile from exile, this is sanctuary. The family name is not known here as it is in Manhattan, in the village, and in the saloons of the Upper East Side where the brothers have made their mark. Here am I, up from my brief apprenticeship in the world of Manhattan cocktail parties, where the tinkle of polite conversation matches the gentle rattle of the ice in the glasses. Manhattan, where elegant women of the Upper East Side, women in black dresses and pearls, will ask me with glittering, if brittle, interest if I am going to school. And I tell them, yes, I am. That seems to be what they want to hear. Yes, I am, I tell them. Yes, I can. Yes, I will. Yes, I would. Anything you want. Anything. Just say the word, I would tell them, if I were not so tongue-tied. I can only nod in agreement as the blood rushes to my face and they shine at me and tell the brothers that I am very bright. Especially on New Year's Eve, when Maliki and his wife arranged a date for me. She was the daughter of a well-known literary personality. We were to attend a formal party. I had no tux, so Maliki lent me his old one. In The Cruel Sea, Nicholas Montserrat describes a woman whose clothing was equipped with a quick-release device. She was always ready. Maliki's suit must have had some thousands of miles on it. Somewhere along the line, the seam, which usually holds together the crotch part, where the scrotum hangs out or hangs in, as the case may be, had abandoned ship, leaving a vacancy and a very breezy point. A hole in your pants, especially in that area, is not reassuring, especially when you're headed out for an evening. But at age 22, chance was all. Putting my best foot forward, I tried really to put both feet forward, both at the same time. Cheeks and thighs had to be held together at all times. Bow from the waist? I would if I had to. Just don't ask me to dance. Miss Kate and I were chatting as we strolled the party. We tasted the food, drank some, and toasted the new year. We left the party early, stepping into the winter air, the very brisk winter air. But at 22, neither snow nor sleet would stay. I had no doubt that Miss Kate was puzzled at my antics. I had moved around so casually at the party. Now in the street, in an attempt to shield the jewels from winter chill and from a revelation, I was walking sideways. Most of all, I was in mortal fear of being exposed. Back at her parents' apartment, we got together mighty hot and mighty quick on the couch. We moved along. My partner was a woman of some experience, while I was ready, and too ignorant. Yes, thank you.
So this is Alfie's first effort, and I'm going to begin with a question that basically gets at the heart of all memoirs, and that is, why? What inspired you to become a memoirist?
I was warned about this question, and I was warned not to deliver any kind of disquisition or any kind of dissertation. And I was told to say, how should I know? I know nothing about it. I just did it. And I'm sticking to that. But I can say that I've been writing bits and pieces all my life, as some people can attest who had suffered by them and some suffered from them. But then with came Angela's Ashes and subsequent books and Malachi's book, Among Swimming, and then we did a thing a week ago or 2 weeks ago up at Marymount College, and the same question came up, and I said that in my daily life I didn't know whether I was coming or going at that time, because all these books were swirling around, and in my life I have met tons of people, five different lives. I never know where I know people from, and I found people looking at me, even on my own street. They're looking at me in this questioning way. Of course, I have the family resemblance, but then people would say, are you? And I would say, I am. And they'd say, you are? And I would say, I am. And then they would say, you're not. And then I say, no, you're not. And then they say, but are you? And I say, but so finally, I decided where there was various people kept asking me, when is your book coming out? So I had an opportunity to go down to Pennsylvania for 4 days in seclusion. There's me and my maker and the deer, and I came back with something which is quite different from what I have now. So that's a rough answer to the question. But I also said that I didn't want to be a footnote to the history of my own family. That's one reason. It was a very ponderous thing to say. I withdraw it. I never said it, but I said it. And I said recently to somebody that I wanted to round up a few people to attend my funeral. That's more the point.
And what advice, if you received any helpful comments from your brothers, did you get before or after you had written your memoir?
I think they advised me not to be reverential, not to be serious, and not to be ponderous, they said essentially write it and don't show it to anybody, and especially don't show it to anybody in the family.
And you have this beautiful product to share with the world. Your story happens to be a lot about struggle. Not a fantasy book, and doesn't talk about a real arrival, but there is a strengthening of your character that happens, and an arc that lands you in New York City, finally grounded. How did we get there?
Well, I did a lot of moving around in my life. I, as I was saying before, the temptation to get up and leave the editing and leave the book and say, to hell with it, I had done that too many times. It's great. I think it's great if you're born with a passion for something and you stick to that and you use that to ground you all your life, even though you may wander off in different directions. If you have this one passion, you hold on to that, and it keeps you. I didn't have that. I had grandiose ideas, but it was too fond of sleeping late too many times, and it's not a good combination. So this book is finished, and I've finished a few things in my life, but too many things I have left undone. So I see other people, they have. I used to envy people who have a career. I could never conceive of having a career, because having a career pretty much means that you have to work within an organization, and I had a very difficult time working within any organization. And I will not use the word Maverick, I swear. But it hangs in the air there somewhere.
Maybe Jack of all trades. Speaking of Jack of all trades, you've had a variegated experience with different careers or different odd jobs, from anything in New York, being a bank teller, to being a bartender, to being a number 10 can inspector. Which of those jobs would you say really impacted you the most, or was the most memorable of them all?
The restaurant business is a great education. It's a wonderful education. But you pay, as I see now, fees are going up in New York for NYU, something like $50,000 a year. And if you're in the restaurant business, you pay a fee, only you can't always measure it. But it gives you a great deal of exposure to a great variety of people, the restaurant business. Especially if you get to own a restaurant, you get there is a certain status in it, in owning a restaurant. You can meet prominent people, celebrities. The danger is that you can become to think that you're a celebrity yourself. That's a caveat. You have to watch out for that, because once you walk out the door, you just... This is why I used to say so many restaurant owners never leave the premises, because when they go outside, they're nobody. So they sit there all day. They sit scowling at everyone and watching the cash register and watching the cash register. Although I did hear of one place where, up on the east side, where they had two cash registers unknown to the owners. So, you know, they didn't take the cash register. They brought in an extra one, and no one ever noticed. Very handy. So I suppose the owner should sit and watch the cash register. But I never... it's better to go outside and get some perspective.
So there's one or two phrases that you've told me in the past through our experience in editing, getting to know each other, that you said, never call me this. And it was charming and lyrical. Now, in my experience, you're very charming. And you're also quite lyrical. So what is the disconnect there? Are you in denial?
Well, I think it's a family thing. I think Frank maybe was the first one to say it, and Maliki would certainly agree with it, that for an Irishman to be described as charming and lyrical can be kind of dismissive, because Irishmen are, by definition, expected to be charming or lyrical. You're supposed to be a poet or a writer, singer, or whatever. So, and besides, I always felt that there is no sex appeal in charming, and sex appeal is crucial if you want to sell anything. So charming and lyrical. I remember Frank saying that he expected to appear in the New York Times among new and noteworthy, right? Charming and lyrical. I kept that in mind, so I may have been a bit over emphatic with Rachel. You'll have to forgive me for that, but I had to do it.
You're forgiven. Now that we know that you are charming and lyrical, a lot of the places in the book you bring in old Irish songs, verses, even just sayings that had just basically you heard daily around the house. Do you have a song prepared by chance?
I do. There was a rumor. There was a rumor of a song. It's a song that was written by... my old friend and neighbor, Ed McCurdy, who flourished not far from here in the village. First time I ever saw him, he was MC at a show which featured the young Bob Dylan. I just wandered in, I was drinking, and I wandered in, and there was McCurdy and this young fellow, Bob Dylan, and I had never seen anyone play a harmonica and a guitar at the same time. That's who it was. McCurdy introduced him, and he sang. Later on, McCurdy moved into our building, and our name being McCourt and his name being McCurdy, we got some of his mail by mistake, and Len took his mail down to him, and he was furious. How could they possibly mix up this McCourt and McCurdy? But later we became friends, and he wrote the song, Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream. Last night I had the strangest dream I never dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room. Room was filled with men, and the paper they were signing said, "We'd never fight again." And when the paper was all signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and bowed their heads, and grateful prayers were prayed. And the people in the street below were dancing round and round, and swords and guns and uniforms were scattered on the ground. Last night I had the strangest dream I never dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war. Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.